I believe that as often as I transgress, God is more ready to forgive me than I am ready to offend. This is the incredible God who reaches out to us through his incredible Son, Jesus Christ. And he says, come, all is forgiven.
This is Mission 66, a ministry of TWR in partnership with the teaching ministry of Dr. Luis Seau. Join us as we discover the timeless truths of the Bible, book by book, chapter by chapter. Today, we investigate the deep history of Israel's royalty in 1 Chronicles. John Matthews and Esther Sisulu will be our guides. Download the free study guide at mission66.org. As we begin, ask God to open your heart to his word.
Today, we are reading through the book of 1 Chronicles, which details a history of the southern kingdom Judah prior to the Babylonian captivity, which came about in 586 BC. Now, last time we read the first 9 chapters, which are mainly lists of genealogies from creation all the way up to the Babylonian captivity of Judah. And as we join our teacher, John Matthews, we'll see the death of Saul and the crowning of David as Saul's replacement. And the theme, obedience leads to lasting success.
Esther, thank you so much. And a very warm welcome to Mission 66. Wherever you're joining us from today, it is so good to have your company. And whatever your situation right now in life, you are so welcome right here. Great to have you then. As we make our way through the Bible, finding ourselves today in 1 Chronicles chapters 10 through 11 and 12 today. And you know, the narration here is from Judah's perspective. Now, it's either been written by Ezra, who was a priest who lived during the time right after the Judeans began coming back from captivity to Jerusalem. So either Ezra, or may have been by other members of the priesthood, based on the fact that the writer is eloquent and he knows intimate details of what he's writing about here. And this retelling in this book spans from what we previously read. That was in the first book of Samuel to the end of the second book of Kings. And chapter 10 here recounts what we've already seen at the close of the first book of Samuel, and that is Saul's last defeat at the hands of the Philistines and then his death. So let's read chapter 10, which says, now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and they fell slain on Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and they struck down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, the sons of Saul. And the battle pressed hard against Saul, and the archers found him, and he was wounded by the archers. And then Saul turned to his armor bearer, and he said, draw your sword and thrust me through with it, lest these uncircumcised come and mistreat me. But his armor bearer would not do as Saul said, for he feared greatly. So Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died. Thus Saul died, he and his 3 sons and all his house died together. And when all the men of Israel who were in the valley saw that the army had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, well, they abandoned their cities and they fled. And the Philistines came and they lived in their cities. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they discovered Saul and his sons fallen on Mount Gilboa, and they stripped him and took his head and his armor and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to their idols and to the people. And they put Saul's armor in the temple of their gods, and they fastened his head in the temple of Dagon. But when all Jabesh-Gilead heard all that the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men arose, and they took away the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons, and they brought them to Jabesh. And they buried their bones under the oak in Jabesh, and then they fasted for 7 days.
John, from what I can recall, what we've read in the Bible, Saul was Israel's first king, but unfortunately he ultimately was rejected by God due to his failure to follow God's instructions.
Yeah, that's right, Esther. David was on the rise. Saul's position was flawed because of his growing pride in the face of these battle victories, where he was pretty pleased with himself, to be honest. And in being pleased with himself, he takes his eyes off God and so becomes fixated with his own success, his own glory. His head is turned by the attention of people who think, oh, he's doing so well, isn't he? And in having his head turned, in doing this, he disobeys God and he comes to rely upon his own flawed and limited wisdom and logic. Imagine turning away from the wisdom and logic of God and thinking, I'm okay, I think I can do this myself. And what happens? He loses the battle to the Philistines, and fearing this humiliating death at the hands of his enemies, he takes his own life, and his whole family suffer from then on. And then as we go into chapter 11, Esther, we discover David is being appointed king at Hebron. So let's pick up the story here at 1 Chronicles chapter 11, verse 4, where it says, "And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem," that is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. "And the inhabitants of Jebus said to David, 'You will not come in here.' Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. And David said, 'Whoever strikes the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander.' And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first, and so he became chief, and David lived in the stronghold. Therefore, it was called the City of David. And he built the city all around from the Milo in complete circuit. And Joab repaired the rest of the city, and David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him." And then the chapter, Esther, goes on to tell us about a group of warriors who were described as David's mighty men who gave him strong support throughout his kingdom. And their deeds are then listed here as starting in verse 11. And it says, "This is an account of David's mighty men. Jashobeam, who was a Hakmonite, he was chief of the three. He wielded his spear against 300 whom he killed at one time. Next to him, among the three mighty men, was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite. He was with David at Pasdamim when the Philistines were gathered there for battle. And there was a plot of ground that was full of barley. And the men fled from the Philistines, but he took his stand in the midst of that plot and defended it, and killed the Philistines. And the Lord saved them by a great victory. 3 of the 30 chief men went down to the rock to David at the cave of Adullam, when the army of the Philistines was encamped in the valley of Rephaim. And David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then at Bethlehem. And David said longingly, 'Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem that is by the gate.' Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines to draw water out of the well of Bethlehem that was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. But David would not drink it. He poured it out to the Lord and said, "Far be it from me before my God that I should do this. Shall I drink the lifeblood of these men? For at the risk of their lives they brought it." Therefore he would not drink it. These things did the three mighty men. Now Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of the 30, and he wielded his spear against 300 men and killed them and won a name beside the three. He was the most renowned of the 30. And he, Abishai, brother of Joab, became their commander, but he did not attain to the three.
John, let's just take a moment to pause there, because I think it's important to provide some detail as to who these guys were, Abishai and Joab. I mean, according to this account, these were some important figures.
Yeah, they certainly were. And they were some warriors as well, weren't they? Esther, mm-hmm. Abishai and Joab, well, they were nephews of David. And so David puts them in charge of the army later when he became king. And there were others as well beside them. So they were part of David's family, but they had this courage and this blessing upon them, which enabled them to be incredible warriors. You know, we just read there about one man taking down 300. And then you have Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, who was described in verse 22, or is described, as a valiant man of Kabzeel. It says he's a doer of great deeds. He struck down two heroes of Moab. He also went down and struck down a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. And he struck down an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits tall. Now, the Egyptian had in his hand a spear like a weaver's beam. But Benaiah went down to him with a staff, snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand, and killed him with his own spear. These things, it says, did Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and he won a name beside the three mighty men, and he was renowned among the 30, but he did not attain to the three. And David set him over his bodyguard. And then the chapter goes on to list another 46 of David's mighty men without any elaboration of why or what their deeds were. There were also about 30 others who aren't listed. Of special note here was that one of David's mighty men was no less than Uriah the Hittite, the man of whom David arranged his death in battle in order that David could marry Uriah's wife Bathsheba. Now, it's hard, isn't it, to imagine that David, an otherwise godly king, could have been capable of such treachery against such a loyal man. But then, I say it's hard, but there's a voice in my head, Esther, that says, look at your own heart, and then maybe I realise, well, maybe in our human fallen flesh, it isn't that hard. Every heart is capable of sin if certain circumstances and influences are at play. Such is the deceit that the human heart is capable of when it is distant from God.
You know, I feel like we could hone in on that point for quite some time, and I suppose we'll do so in upcoming episodes here on Mission 66, John. But I think let's go ahead and move on to 1 Chronicles chapter 12 and see what this passage says.
Yeah, let's do that. And reading here now, Esther, from verse 1, where it says, "Now these are the men who came to David at Ziklag, while he couldn't move about freely because of Saul, the son of Kish. And they were among the mighty men who helped him in war. They were bowmen, and they could shoot arrows and sling stones with either the right or the left hand. And they were Benjaminites, Saul's kinsmen." Now, it goes on then to list the names of several others. So we're going to skip down to verse 8, which says, "From the Gadites, there went over to David at the stronghold in the wilderness mighty and experienced warriors, expert with shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and who were swift as gazelles upon the mountains. Ezra the chief, Obadiah second, Eliab third, Mishmanah fourth, Jeremiah fifth, Attai sixth, Eliel seventh, Johanan eighth, Elzabad ninth, Jeremiah tenth, Machbanai 11th. These Gadites were officers of the army. The least was a match for 100 men, and the greatest for 1,000. Now these, then, Esther, you can read between the lines fairly clearly, were extraordinarily gifted warriors, of the like that it's hard for us to get our heads around, actually. And verse 15 says, these are the men who crossed the Jordan in the first month when it was overflowing all its banks, and they put to flight all those in the valleys to the east and to the west. And some of the men of Benjamin and Judah came to the stronghold to David. And David went out to meet them, and he said to them, if you have come to me in friendship to help me, my heart will be joined to you. But if to betray me to my adversaries, although there is no wrong in my hands, then may the God of our fathers see and rebuke you. Then the Spirit clothed Amasai, the chief of the 30, and he said, we are yours, O David, and with you, O son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you. And peace to your helpers, for your God helps you.
Wow, you know, you can only just imagine how David must have been so encouraged to hear this, considering how this is the point in which he was being put as king. He was being put in his rightful place. I mean, there's a lot of patience needed on his part.
Well, maybe, but, you know, you look at verse 16 and you put David in this really uncertain position. We only have a verse there, but there's David. He sees them coming, these mighty men of Benjamin and Judah. They come to the stronghold and David's thinking, what is their intention? But what does he do? He goes out to meet them. And there would have been an incredible amount of uncertainty. But then you're right, Esther, then comes this prayer, and you can imagine the relief that David felt, and then the thanksgiving he would have felt towards God. Thank you, Lord. You know, are you with me? Clearly, you are with me. The last line of that prayer, they pray themselves. This is Amasai who says, for your God helps you. And then verse 19 says, some of the men of Manasseh deserted to David when he came with the Philistines for the battle against Saul. Yet he did not help them, for the rulers of the Philistines took counsel and sent him away, saying, at peril to our heads, he will desert to his master Saul. And as he went to Ziklag, these men of Manasseh deserted to him: Adnah, Jozabad, Jediel, Michael, Jozabad, Elihu, and Zelethai, chiefs of thousands in Manasseh. And they helped David against the band of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor, and they were commanders in the army. And from day to day, men came to David to help him, until there was a great army, like an army of God. And so you have these mighty men being drawn towards who? Ultimately towards God. but towards David because of his faith in God. And then the chapter lists the head count of all the warriors who were in each of the divisions then of David's army, and they came from all the tribes because David was now being made king over all Israel, not just in Hebron. And to give us an idea of the numbers involved, well, it says the men of Judah were 6,800, from Simeon 7,100, of the Levites 4,600, the prince Jehoiada of the house of Aaron had 3,700, Zadok, young man mighty in valour, and 22 commanders. There was from Benjamin 3,000, from Ephraim 20,800, of the half-tribe of Manasseh 18,000. Issachar was a tribe who had men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Their input was so useful as well. They also had 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen. From Zebulun, 50,000 seasoned troops. Naphtali had 1,000 commanders and 37,000 men. Dan mustered 28,600 men. Asher, 40,000 seasoned troops ready for battle. And then of the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh from beyond the Jordan, 120,000 men armed with the weapons of war. And they all come to Hebron with a whole heart. And how often have we seen that in the history of Israel? It's almost unique. You know, those times when there's this been this unity, they've been few and far between. But here, they come to Hebron with a whole heart to make David king over all of Israel. At this point, an undivided nation. And it was a time of joy because everyone agreed that David should be king over all. And so there was a 3-day celebration. And in the next episode, we'll see David move into Jerusalem, bring the Ark of the Covenant with him. And so there are exciting times ahead for this king who loves and honours God above all things.
This is Mission 66, and we're here with our teacher, John Matthews, who's leading us through these three chapters of the book of First Chronicles. And of course, there are some questions that I have up my sleeve, John. And I have to mention that it's quite interesting to witness some of the detail mentioned in First Chronicles that we haven't quite seen in some of the other books that we read. But let's get into it. So you mentioned that Saul lost his kingdom by not following God's instructions. So how about we go ahead and remind our listeners what it was that he did to lose the favor of God?
Yeah, well, you're right, Esther, because Saul was God's pick to be the first king over Israel. And he started out well. He was humble. He demonstrates an ability to rally the troops. He meets threats with resolution and decisiveness. But the problem was in Saul's heart. And as time went on, he begins to treat his connection with God very lightly and then disregards divine instruction from Samuel the prophet. For example, he was told to wipe out the Amalekites and make sure that he killed all of their livestock. And yet he spares the best of the sheep. And he was told to execute Agag, the treacherous Amalekite king. But he lets him live, perhaps wanting to lord it over Agag and demonstrate his mighty victory. But there's such risk involved with his decision. And the problem is the victory was not Saul's. It was God's. And so one thing after another shows that he's doing things pretty much as Saul wants to do them and asking God, if you don't mind, give us a hand with this. And so God begins withdrawing from him. And what happens then? Well, he becomes violent and abusive and inconsistent and unpredictable, tries to hunt David down and tries to kill him. And finally, he consults a medium, the Witch of Endor, instead of seeking divine counsel. But not only did Saul do all of those things incorrectly, I suppose, or not the way that, you know, he wasn't supposed to do things this way. He also didn't actively do right. So we don't see him pursuing righteousness. And when he's confronted with his mistakes, he has loads of excuses on hand. Unlike David, who, when he was confronted with his sin and confesses it and repents and desires and longs to be back on the right path. You know, in our walk with the Lord, it's not only avoiding the evil, but it's pursuing the right way, actively doing the things that are right and virtuous. You know, the English preacher Charles Spurgeon once said, "I believe that as often as I transgress, God is more ready to forgive me than I am ready to offend." And we are ready to offend as human beings with fallen hearts. Make no mistake about that. And sometimes we think there's such sin. How do we get past it? But this brilliant quote from Spurgeon says, "I believe that as often as I transgress, which is an awful lot, God is more ready to forgive me than I am ready to offend." That is incredible forgiveness. And this is the incredible God who reaches out to us through his incredible Son, Jesus Christ, and says, "Come, come to me. All is forgiven." But here we have Saul, whose gaze has been enchained by his own pride. And he turns from looking up to God to the situation where he's unable to look anywhere other than at himself. And so the Philistines finish him off. But really, Saul loses his kingdom little by little over time. And following this, the chapter then shifts attention to David and the focus on a king's behaviour, especially with regard to his relationship with God and his desire to adhere to God's way. And that becomes then a central theme in this book of Chronicles, Esther.
Yeah, absolutely it does. And you know, in chapter 10, it says that the entire house of Saul had died. But if I remember correctly, I think there were some of his family members who did survive, people like Ish-bosheth and Mephibosheth.
Yeah, you're right. The chapter says that Saul and his three sons died, and so the entire royal lineage. But there would have been some grandsons in that royal line who'd not yet been killed, and among those was Ish-bosheth and, as you mentioned there, Jonathan's sons, Mephibosheth.
So let's look at what verse 14 says. It says, "Therefore the Lord put him, that is Saul, to death and turned the kingdom over to David." But we know that, you know, Saul committed suicide. He took his own life. And I wonder then why the text says that it was the Lord who killed him when Saul ultimately made that decision.
Yeah, well, the Hebrew verb here, Esther, gives the sense that the Lord handed him over to death, which is a little different way of saying it. And we could also see that God foresaw that Saul, as he drifted away from God and trusted in himself, that this was the end that he was heading towards.
Okay. Well, now in turning our attention to David, why was it that David made this decision to rule from Jerusalem, considering that there were so many other cities that he perhaps could have ruled from?
There were, but Jerusalem was probably the most obvious choice. It was in this high location. Sometimes you may have heard Jerusalem referred to even today as a city on the hill. And so it's well positioned to defend against a threat. It's also located on a tribal border. And so it's or was considered by some to be relatively neutral territory, one that is accessible by all the diverse tribes of Israel. And if we look ahead into the prophecy, it's clear that God had special plans for Jerusalem. This was the place where Jesus would come and he would die and rise again. The Bible also talks about a new Jerusalem at the end of the present age. Now, we don't know exactly what that is or what that will look like, but it talks about Jerusalem in special terms.
Well, we certainly do see that theme throughout the Bible. Jerusalem, very special to God. John, thank you so much. These are such helpful insights. And I think with all that we've covered, let's go ahead and summarize 1 Chronicles chapters 10 through to 12.
Yeah, and these are chapters, Esther, that recount key moments in Israel's history. They focus on Saul's tragic end and the rise of David as king. The theme was obedience leads to lasting success. Chapter 10, we saw Saul defeated at Mount Gilboa, details his death and the fall of his own sons as well in that battle against the Philistines. And Saul's rejection by God, it stems from his refusal to obey God, to follow God. And so that failure leads to his downfall. Then chapter 11 highlights David being anointed as king at Hebron and his conquest of Jerusalem from the Jebusites and establishing it there as the city of David. We also hear about his mighty men. Chapter 12 describes the growing support for David during his time in Ziklag as warriors from various tribes now then come to join him. And these guys, they were skilled, courageous, and they were committed to David's cause. And they form a unified army that prepares to establish him as king over all of Israel. And this episode today, it just emphasizes obedience to God's covenant, to God's way, leadership qualities. It shows the unity therein. And next time we're going to find David making a landmark decision to bring the Ark of the Covenant from Kiriath Jearim to Jerusalem. So be sure to join us for that.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to our continuation through the book of 1 Chronicles, and it is fascinating. So be sure to join us same time, same place here on Mission 66. And I do want to make mention of our deep appreciation for your prayers and financial support, friend, because it enables us to continue this program, not only in English, but also in Spanish, Indonesian, and in other languages as well. So thank you. And if you would like to consider making a donation to the ministry, please do visit mission66.org. That's mission66.org. Well, I'm Esther for John Matthews and everybody here on our team. Until next time, may God bless you.
As we close today's program, take a minute to download your free study guide. You'll be able to follow along every single day. Plus, you can engage with the reflection and application questions so you can apply the teaching to your life. It's a great companion resource to the audio Bible teaching of John Matthews and Esther Sisulu. To get your free study guide, visit mission66.org. That's mission66.org. You can also support the ministry of Mission 66 when you visit the site. Your gift makes it possible for this great teaching to be heard in many languages around the world. Mission 66 is a ministry of Transworld Radio in partnership with Dr. Luis Seau.